afternoon. So, last time we started by talking about least recently used and looked at some examples about how that would apply to our page cache and talked about, well, if that's sort of what we want to do, you know, sort of we're assuming this locality idea, can we implement it? And well, the answer is yes, but it's not practical. That to implement it, we need to like run some code every time that a page is accessed, and that's just going to be way too slow. So instead, we talked about kind of approximating it. And our big tool for that was that we'd track these referenced or accessed. You'll see both names and things that talk about this idea. It's referenced or accessed bit for each sort of page that is around. And, you know, we can do this by either having the hardware set a bit in our page table entries, so that's a common feature to help OSs out with this, or if the hardware doesn't help us in that way, we can mark a page as invalid and see when we get a page fault to know that, yes, it was accessed. So this doesn't tell us about every single access, but it tells us, you know, that it was accessed in some time window, and using that information, we can implement these policies that, you know, aren't least recently used, but they're kind of not recently used, which are, you know, they're something related to it. And we went over one example of maybe the simplest way of using this referenced bit, which was this second chance policy. Here we kept an ordered list of pages where pages started at the top of the list and we took from the bottom. And if we just took from the bottom and used that page, we'd end up with a policy called FIFO, first in, first out, which, you know, is not horrendous, but doesn't take advantage of when we're actually accessing pages. So what we did instead is we said, well, we'll check the reference bit. We'll see, was it referenced while it was on the list, since we put it at the top? And if the answer is yes, we'll put it back at the top of the list and give it a second chance, marking it as unreferenced because, well, we're guessing it's not going to be important, but maybe we'll be wrong. And if we are wrong, we'll find out because when it gets to the bottom of the list, we'll see, oh, no, it's still being used, shouldn't evict it. Then we talked about some refinements of this. So a problem with the second chance strategy is that if we have a very large number of pages, which is probably sort of any modern system where we have gigabytes of memory, then, you know, by the time things make it from the top of a list to the bottom of the list with, you know, millions of pages on it, it's likely to have been referenced and, you know, we'll have to spend a lot of time scanning. And also we're kind of, you know, being a little imprecise, that we're only going to evict pages, you know, that it's been a really long time since they're being used, when really we kind of just care about evicting pages which, you know, aren't being used right now, which is going to be a much shorter time window. And a way we could manage this, and what we mentioned is what Linux has chosen to do, is that we have a subset of the pages, which Linux called the inactive list, of pages that we're going to kind of guess are being unused. And we'll verify that guess, like with the second chance policy, by seeing if they're referenced while they're on that inactive list. But because we control the size of that inactive list to be a subset of the pages, this manages our sensitivity to when we're looking for things being used and limits how much we're going to have to scan through list of pages. And I also mentioned sort of another way we could generalize second chance is that rather than, you know, checking these referenced bits sort of as we're like looking for pages, we can just sort of periodically scan them, where the period, you know, there's lots of choices, and there's all sorts of approximations of this LRU-like policy that can come out of that. So after looking at those approximations of LRU, we try to like re-examine our assumptions about how programs access memory. And one thing we found is that while temporal locality is mostly the case, there's some important exceptions. And one big important exception were these scanning patterns, where we're going through a large file from beginning to end. You know, that typically wouldn't follow the sort of least recently used idea that after we read the beginning of the file, we're likely to read that again soon. For, you know, a movie, that's really not the case most of the time. And so we saw to deal with that, you know, one solution is that we can have sort of exceptions to our LRU-like policy. And this is exactly what Linux did. Linux tried to, you know, identify things that were likely these sort of one-time scans of a file and kind of exempt them from the usual LRU policy, but opt them back into the LRU policy if they end up being used, you know, soon enough. Another thing we noticed with this is that we have been assuming that we're not going to read stuff in until the program accesses it. And a lot of the time, this was a big performance benefit because we could start programs running before they actually, you know, had all their stuff loaded. And if a program's not using some big part of, you know, its data, we might avoid ever loading in. That's obviously going to be faster in most cases. But often we can kind of predict what the program's going to access, and we really want to take advantage of that and sort of read it in advance. So, you know, one big idea that a lot of OSs do is this idea called read ahead, where we look for these scanning patterns by sort of doing some observations of when programs are accessing pages. How do we do these observations? So one way is we can sort of mark them as invalid temporarily to see if there's a page fault. And when we detect those sort of those patterns that go periodically, we can read things that we think the program is going to access again soon. Sort of access, not again, access for the first time soon. And hopefully stay ahead of the program and make it so when it does access that thing, you know, it doesn't have to wait for it to be read off disk or wherever it happens to be stored. And related to this, there's other things we could do proactively to kind of speed up this process. So one thing is that when I was introducing this idea that, oh, if a program modifies a file, you know, we're going to modify the cache version of that file, but we don't need to send it back to disk right away. And I showed us like sending it back to disk only when we were getting rid of it from our cache. But in practice, we'd want to like do that earlier, you know, to save time later on, also to make sure that disk is up to date. And similarly, if we're thinking about freeing up pages in general, we'd like it to when the program like needs more stack space, that we don't need to do a lot of work to get the page to give it to allocate that extra space. So something an OS might do that's very common and helpful for performance is they might free a few pages in advance so those requests go much faster. So questions about these things we covered last time? Before we move on and look again at next topic, which we started briefly last time, which was about devices and how we do I/O. Okay, so not seeing anything. So when we finished off last time, we started looking at how input and output worked. And we mentioned this idea that we'd have this buffer in the kernel, and in the case of sort of files, this buffer is, you know, part of the page cache, most likely, where, say, when we were reading from the keyboard, we'd actually be reading from this buffer where as key presses happened, kernel would have put those key presses. And when you're reading from a file, we're actually reading from this buffer where the kernel would have loaded a cache copy of the file, and you're reading from that cache copy. That cache copy is the one in our page cache. And similarly for writing, when we're writing something, say, to the network or to the terminal, you know, we'd have some buffer where we're waiting for the network to be ready to send it, and the OS would actually send it when it's ready. And when we're writing to a file, we'd have a buffer, which is our, you know, cache copy of the file in the page cache, where we'd store that data, and when we were ready to write it to the disk, which is when we decided to write it, and when the disk is actually ready, you know, to receive it, that we'd actually send it out to the disk. And this idea that we're going to have these buffers here, that the operating system inside the kernel is going to keep, you know, this data that is either waiting to go to a device for output or came from a device and is waiting to go to a program, you know, is going to, you know, influence how our typical code that communicates with these devices is structured. And you could say, well, couldn't we, you know, maybe avoid this and make it so when you do this print care, we don't buffer it, but we send it directly? And yes, that is possible, but this is not typically what we're going to do. Now, we talk about buffering I/O. Often we're talking about not the buffering that the kernel is doing, but buffering that's being done in libraries. So like if you use cout or printf, they do their own buffering, which is completely independent and in addition to the buffering I just talked about that's being done by the kernel. So like if you printf a, then printf b, printf's going to try to write these two characters, well, these three characters, all in one call to write. Even though, yeah, you could write A, then write B, then write new line, or write A, and then write B a new line, two or three separate calls. It's going to try to do it in one call, because that's going to be more efficient. And we're going to have some similar things for input, where if you say, try to, you know, read until a new line, that, you know, fgets or getline, you know, the library functions that do that for you, are typically going to try to do a big call to read and look for a new line in the output rather than getting character by character from the OS and looking for the new line. So, we have this layering, and we're going to look at how we actually talk to devices in the kernel. But to talk about that, I need to kind of talk about, well, sort of what's happening, you know, in between. So you can, like, think of what this code that actually communicates with devices is doing. And we're going to call the code that actually communicates with the device a device driver. And there's kind of two interfaces that this device driver is going to sit on top of within the kernel. So we have sort of this generic read, write, mmap interface for files. And for things like disks, we're going to go through something called a file system, which we'll talk about as our next topic, that's going to decide where to put these multiple files on one single device, which would typically be like a hard drive or a solid state disk. We'll also have files that represent things that are other types of devices, like our terminal or sort of a network device or something like that. And we're going to say that these are represented as a device file. And for things like the network, there might be another layer I'm not showing in front of this, but this is device file we can think of as like for the keyboard or the screen will represent as a file, and the device driver is what implements the file operations. And if we're talking about these things where there's a device file, well, the device driver is basically going to provide its own version of open, its own version of read, its own version of write, and its own version of close that when you use that particular file are going to access not, you know, a regular file, not some piece of cache data or talk to a disk to move that data into cache or out of cache, but are going to do something special depending on the type of device. And when I say these are files, you might say, okay, so, you know, my standard in is a file, but, you know, that doesn't really have a name. These device files, we're typically going to give them a name on a Unix-like system. So, for example, on my Linux desktop, I have devices like this, which my sort of OS have chosen to put in this dev directory. And I, for example, have a device that is for audio playback. So if you want to play audio out through the speakers or headphone jack, you open this up and you write audio data to it. There's devices, files that represent the hard drives. Now, I'm not going to usually access these device files directly, but tools that would say like format a disk, this is how they're going to have the OS access the disk on their behalf. There's devices that correspond to the mouse and the keyboard. We open them up, and when you call read, you don't get like data from a file, you get a list of key presses and mouse events. There's a device that corresponds to the screen. So you open this up, and there's some way of writing things to it or writing to something you mmap that will put stuff on the screen. So I talked about having this sort of read-write interface, and for the most part it seems like pretty straightforward, but writing or reading should do. Writing should play audio. Reading and writing should read parts of the disk. Reading should read key presses and mouse movements. Writing should put something on the screen. But sometimes this isn't really enough. And one example is that audio output device. There's a lot of different ways I might format my audio data, and often the hardware that handles producing that audio output will support a bunch of them. How do we set that? If I think of using a terminal, so we'll have a device that represents a terminal. Sometimes I want what the user types to be echoed back for me. Sometimes I don't. There's a way to configure that. If I think of like a optical disk, a CD or a DVD, often there's a way of programmatically opening the disk tray. Well, how that shouldn't be a write operation. That's not like changing the CD, which is what we think of the file representing. Also, we want to know, like, is there a disk in there? And that's, you know, that's not really a read operation, it's something else. So we'll want some extra operations. And POSIX has decided for this reason to provide some extra special file descriptor calls that typically would turn into system calls. The most notable for devices is this thing called IOCTL, where basically, a device can add, you know, any number of operations at once, and sort of the generic interface is IOCTL file descriptor and a number, and the device driver chooses what numbers make sense, and an argument, and the device driver chooses how to interpret that argument. And this is a way for adding all these extra things, like set an audio format or check if a disk is present, that a device might want. There's also a few other interfaces for terminal settings. POSIX has a completely different function for so-called pseudo-terminals, which are the special devices that are used to communicate between your terminal program and programs that are running in the terminal. And there's also some extra operations under the FCNTL function, some of which you might think might make more sense under IOCTL, but they made some choices. Another thing you'll often see when we have these cases where you want to like configure audio is that you could provide for one device driver a lot of different device files. So a device driver that's talking to one physical device doesn't actually need to have just one device file. And for audio devices, Linux, for example, has a whole bunch of things for one audio controller. So for example, on that same desktop, there's this audio control device, which just exists for setting up like the volume settings and things like that. And there are multiple audio outputs you can use, so they have a separate device file for each of them, even though they all go through the same chip. So, given that we have these sort of device drivers implementing these device files, so you might say, well, what does the device driver sort of do? And, you know, so from, you know, the simplest point of view, well, the device driver is just filling in this struct here of what should be done for a read, for a write, for an IOCTL, for an MMAP, for an open, for a close, which turns into this release call. And in Linux, this is a struct of function pointers. So the device driver supplies a read function and a write function and an IOCTL function and an MMAP function and so on, and implements its own version of what all those things should do. And you might say that seems like a lot of redundant code, and it can be, but there's going to be some generic versions that they can use. So for example, if a device doesn't support writing, there's some way they can set this write thing to a version which just always fails that, you know, is provided in, as sort of common library code. So what I've shown you here, this makes a lot of sense for these devices that I open directly, but it doesn't actually make so much sense for this file system case. So Linux and most other Unix-like OSs, including basically XV6, have a special case for what are called block devices. And why the special cases? Well, because these things need to work with the page cache, and the page cache doesn't really do read or write operations like the read or write system call. It wants to access whole pages at a time. So on Linux, the way this works is that there's a different functions they implement, and the main one they have to implement is this read or write a whole page function. And this is what is used for things that interact with the page cache. And the other types of devices are typically called character devices because read or write works a byte at a time and implement that read or write interface instead of this read or write a whole page interface. And not remark that the IOCTL arguments fall off the page? Yes. So the question is, here, what does it look like when file systems access these types of devices? So your question is like, you know, this isn't a file on disk, right? So how does that work? And what most Unix likes do is that when the file system's storing a file, it has some flags that say whether it's a normal file or it's some special type of file. And one of the special types of file is this device file. And on disk, what we'll store for this instead of, you know, actual file data is we'll store an identifier that lets the OS find which device driver to use. So another question, is a device driver a collection of device files? So a device driver will implement a collection of device files. Yes. So, yeah, and I got, and we'll go through, we'll look at exactly what device files look like a little later. So a question, does the OS define a bunch of device files that a driver comes in and interacts with? So generally the OS will come with a bunch of device drivers and it kind of has to have them built in, because otherwise, you know, you can't do anything, because we needed a device driver to, you know, start, have files in the first place. And if we don't have files, we can't execute any programs. And we need a device driver to talk to the keyboard. So there's going to be a bunch of device drivers built into the OS, and there's going to be some sort of bootstrapping process where we can somehow, you know, set things up even though there's no device file set up yet. And one way this might work is that you might have a special case for the device drivers for the initial file system to make sure that they, you know, you don't need to have like a device file existing to start that, to create that. So we have these device drivers. So let's look at what the device driver code looks like. And so far we've talked about sort of the device driver implements the file interface, but this is not all of what the device driver's code is going to be triggered from. And the reason is that, you know, this is this part which is triggered from the application making a request, but the device driver also needs to respond to things happening on the device. Like if I press a key, the device driver should run, you know, even if we're not in the middle of, you know, doing a read from the keyboard. So there's just going to be this other part of the device driver, which is going to be called from the trap handler. And we're going to call the part that's called from an application request, the top half, and the part that's called from the trap handler, the bottom half. And the device driver is going to have, you know, basically sort of two types of code it runs. So one type that's going to run from a read or a write call, and one type that's going to run as part of something like trap. And it's going to have to arrange with the OS that, you know, both of these get triggered at the appropriate times. That the part from the read or write call happens when some application tries to use the device file, or say the file system uses the device driver. And the trap handler is going to happen when the exception that the device triggers occurs. So in the case of a key press, we have an exception for a key press happening. The keyboard driver is going to arrange for that to run its code. So I mentioned this idea that that we're going to have these device drivers stored on disk. And I can concretely tell you like how this works in XV6. So in XV6, we have to do something special to load the initial file system. But once we do that, we can have these device files. In XV6, the device files just have a read or write operation. And to figure out which device driver to use, XV6 just has an array of all the possible device files. And the device drivers just populate this array, and, well, there's indexes in this array. And what they've decided in XV6 is that each device driver is going to be assigned a different index for each of its device files. And a file on disk is going to store what they call a device number, which is going to be an index into this array. And you can create that special file with this make note system call, and it's just stored as a file with special information saying, oh, there's no data for this, it just has, just use this device number. And this is very similar to what typical Unix or Linux systems do, except they typically, instead of having a single number in a single array, they have two numbers, and they're probably not using an array, but some other sort of lookup table. Question, what does the SW mean here? I am not sure. So question, is this an array of device driver implementations? You can think of it that way, yes. And at boot, we have to set up this array, and XV6 has code to do that. And the way that looks is we have this code run at boot, which just sets the entries for the console, which is basically the only device that XV6 really supports, to point to the device driver functions console read and console write. And XV6 has chosen that console is the constant 1. 0 is set to, I think, a device driver which does nothing, which commonly exists on other, like Linux, for dev null is a device which, you know, if you read or write, it just doesn't do anything. So what do these console read and console write functions do? So we're going to look at that. And that's, remember, you know, what happens here. That, you know, we get a request to say read from our console. XV6 says, oh, this is from this first device here. I look up the read function. I'm going to call the read function. And that read function is going to look in buffers. Remember, we have a buffer for our input and buffers for our output. So it's going to check that buffer and it's going to say, okay, can I satisfy it there? And if it can, we're just going to store the data from the buffer, copy from the buffer, and return. So that's the simple case. The less simple case is that we look in the buffer and, well, we haven't had enough key presses yet. So in that case, you know, we have sort of things we might need to do. So we might need, in some devices, we'll need to like tell the device, hey, someone's trying to read data or someone's trying to write data, get ready for that. In the case of a keyboard, that's not going to be necessary because the keyboard's kind of always going to give us data. But if we think of something like a network card, you know, we might need to do some preparation for reading or writing. And then we're going to put the thread that was calling read or write to sleep to wait for us to actually be ready to perform the operation. So in the case of reading from the console, here's the code from XV6 which does it. So XV6 has this buffer for keyboard input called input. And it keeps track of the reading and the writing location in this buffer. So the writing location is updated, going to be updated from the trap handler. And the reading location is what we're going to update here as we copy things out of the buffer. And it's saying, as long as we haven't written ahead of where we're reading from, you know, wait. And this wait operation, we're waiting on this input.r, and there's going to be a corresponding wake up operation in our trap handler. So a question is this sleep the same as waiting on a condition variable? It's very similar. after we're done waiting here, we're going to actually do store the data in the result. Or if we don't have to wait, we'll do that right away. And the way that looks like in console read is that we get a pointer to where the user wants the data, and we just copy character by character. And XV6 has chosen this rule that it copies until we read n characters or get a new line. Could have chosen something else, but you know, it just chose a time to stop based on the read call or seeing a new line, and then returns how much it actually copied. So that's the top half, but you can see that this depends on our trap handler doing the actual work of getting stuff from the keyboard. So how does that work? Well, there's some code in trap which deals with this, and there's actually a couple places this comes up because there's multiple ways XV6 can get keyboard input, but sort of the most straightforward is the keyboard triggering this keyboard interrupt request, which has this trap number here. And that runs this function called keyboard inter. And that's where the implementation of the device drivers read from the keyboard and put things in the buffer is. And there's a second LAPCIEOI operation. This is named after, I believe, the corresponding field or instruction, but this is to tell the CPU, I'm done with this interrupt. Please don't send it to me again unless something new happens. If we didn't do this, we'd keep getting a keyboard interrupt, because the processor would assume the OS didn't handle it yet. So let's look at our keyboard interrupt function. So this is going to update our buffers. After it does that, we're going to wake up this thread that was put to sleep. And, you know, if we're doing writing, this is where we'd handle maybe writing more, or if we need to do some setup of the device to make it read more, this is where we'd handle doing that. So a question, does this mean that each time you press a key, an interrupt handler is running? So that would be, most of the time you press a key, we would expect an interrupt handler to run. It might be in some cases, like we could get multiple key presses with one trap. Okay. So one question we might have is, wait, how do we do this step here? Like, adding to the buffer makes sense. Waking up the sleeping thread, you know, is like changing the process state. That, you know, we kind of understand, but we haven't seen how do we actually talk to the keyboard controller, the keyboard, and, you know, how does that work? So to talk about this, we need to talk about how is the keyboard actually connected to our processor. And the most common model is that we're going to have our processor connected to what I'll call the memory bus. So this is how it's going to communicate with memory. And it also, some other processors might also be connected to the same memory bus, but we'll also connect our devices to this memory bus. And, well, we won't actually connect the, like, physical keyboard directly. We'll have a controller. So there'll be some specialized little chip that manages talking between the keyboard and the processor, that kind of changes from, you know, getting key presses to doing something with the memory bus. And since we're connected to the memory bus, we can see when the processor is trying to read from some memory address or write to some memory address. And so what we're going to do in this device controller is we're going to make it appear as if our keyboard is accessible as some memory locations. So we're going to have what we'll call these control registers, which tell us about the state of the keyboard or whatever other device we're using. And we're going to give these control registers a memory address and we're going to make that work because when the processor wants to, you know, read or write one of these memory addresses, it's going to send a message out on this memory bus, and this device controller can respond to that message rather than the actual memory responding. And when we have this read or write, the device controller can cause these values to change. And I said that these are registers, but they don't actually need to be registers. Because the device controller sort of has hardware which is getting the I'm reading or writing this signal, you know, it can interpret reads or writes to these values differently. So for example, maybe we'll interpret a write to this location here, marked write question mark, as telling the device controller to send something out through the external hardware rather than modifying some value. Now, in addition to these control registers, which are going to give kind of meta information, the device controller can also have its own buffers or queues. So, like, if we're thinking of talking to, like, a hard disk, you know, the hard disk needs to get its data on, you know, a particular, you know, wire that's going to have a different way of working than the memory bus. So we'll be able to put, you know, the data we want to send there in this buffer on the device controller and then copy it over the memory bus by, you know, copying from the processor, writing to memory, but the memory is actually on the device controller, not here, or reading from memory the same way. So there's a question here. Does this mean that there are going to be reserved addresses for these device controllers? And the answer is yes. So we're going to have some way of choosing these addresses such that they don't conflict with the addresses of actual memory and they don't conflict with each other. And, you know, if we want to support lots of devices, we would probably actually need to do some work in this, which I'm going to kind of gloss over. So another thing the device controller is going to have, it's going to have a way of sending a please interrupt signal to the processor. So there's some way it can say, trigger that interrupt, but all it's sending is this sort of yes interrupt or no don't interrupt signal. It doesn't have much more detail there. All the sort of real communication is going to happen with this memory bus interface. So far I've kind of shown it as all our devices are connected directly to the memory bus, but often there's a bit of abstraction going on. So commonly there will be what I'll call a bus adapter, which will have its sort of own device controller, you know, that will convert from the memory bus to some other type of bus. And you can kind of think of, say, USB as like working in this sort of way, that there's going to be this USB bus adapter that will convert in between the two. And in this way, we can support sort of different devices that are hooked up in different ways. They don't all have to be, you know, integrated with the memory bus, but we can have this same interface because we have some component that talks to the memory bus and makes it work that way. So since the device controllers kind of expose these memory locations and they can decide what reading and writing them does, you know, we can kind of view our devices as this magic memory. So a way our keyboard controller might work is that when we read from a particular memory location, we get whatever the last key press is because we're actually reading from something in that keyboard controller. And the keyboard controller knows we're doing that read, so it can do something like when we read, it clears it automatically and gives us, puts the next thing there if it, when it's available. So another example is, let's think of writing, you know, to the screen. We could have a display controller where we say write the pixels we want to buffers that are on the display controller, so it, you know, can easily send them directly to the display. And there's a special location we can write to, which triggers that to be sent right away. Oh, sorry. Right away? I was thinking about here. I was not reading my slide correctly. So for, yeah, so special location that triggers that to be sent to the screen. And we can also have memory locations that, you know, end up controlling like the format, for example. For a network interface, we might have a special location that like triggers something to be sent over the Wi-Fi. And we might have sort of a status location, which tells us, you know, are we connected? You know, how much data did I receive? And have some buffers that we can read from, you know, when data is received, and we'll know how much data is there from this sort of status location. So the question, does the device controller have its own processor, or does it execute code on the processor for its handlers? So the device controller, when it's doing any of this stuff, if, you know, writing to a location makes it talk to the network, or if, you know, writing to a location makes the display controller change the format of its output, it has to have its own processor to handle all that, because that's not going to be part of anything that's actually running on the normal main processor. So in some cases, like this keyboard controller, that might be really simple. Like this read from a memory location gives you one byte, and we change what byte that is as we get key presses. That's really simple. This sort of network interface or display controller is a lot more complicated, and you probably have something which, you know, you might consider almost a full-fledged computer as the controller. Other questions? So a question, does the processor find the device on the bus or vice versa? So the simplest way of having the processor know how to find the device is that we just have these locations hard-coded. We just know that I know this device uses these addresses. I'm going to look for them. In practice, we're going to have to do something where, you know, we have some way that the processor can enumerate what the devices are, and those mechanisms exist. They require some other hardware to make them work. And we're not going to talk about how they work in this class. Other questions? Okay, so I've talked about this idea that we can communicate with these devices by reading or writing specific memory locations. Now, there are a few problems with, you know, just doing this. Which is caching. So let's say I have this memory location I read from and I get a value. You know, that's my last key press. So I get, let's say, an H, and then I press E, you know, the OS is going to read from this memory location. And, well, if we think of how our processors work, we have our CPU, we have our, within, you know, the processor, the core, with an L1 cache and an L2 cache. And this H here might get kept in the cache. It probably should be, because it's a value in memory. Why wouldn't we keep it cache so we can avoid the slow accesses to memory? But that's really bad for these device controllers because they're not normal memory. So the OS needs to do something about that, and it needs some help from the hardware to do that, because the hardware would just silently cache this value normally. And so there's going to be hardware support for that. So in x86, there's this extra bit in page table entries where you can say, no caching. And if this bit is set, the processor will avoid accessing the cache if you're using that page table entry to access a virtual address. And when setting up its memory to be able to talk to the device controllers, the OS can arrange to only access that those memory locations using these page table entries that are marked as please do not use caching when you're using this. So a question that, can we think of the addresses on the device controller as function pointers? So I mentioned that some of these sort of reads and writes could trigger, you know, a sort of an operation to happen. And I understand there's an analogy between function pointers and that. A lot of them, though, are going to be kind of more just querying what's going on. So for example, the status location is probably, you know, more analogous to like a shared global variable, you know, about what's going on that's going to be updated, you know, in parallel with the OS running. And that applies to a lot of these locations. And similarly, if we think of like the locations that like control the, say, the screen size for a display controller, you know, it might be more the case that like the display controller is always running and it's going to read from that sort of shared variable to figure out how to send stuff to the display, and that will take effect the next time it needs to send something to the display. Okay, so talked about communicating through these magic memory locations, and now I get to tell you that XV6 doesn't do that. And you might say, if XV6 doesn't do that, why do they just talk about it? And that's because sort of the most common way for new processors is that everything has a special memory location. But historically, x86 had this system where we had a memory bus and an I.O. bus, and they had a very similar interface, but they were separate buses from the processor with different instructions to access them. And what happened is, well, the I.O. bus was slower, so people started putting, you know, fast devices on the memory bus, and then they just said, why are we using this I.O. bus in the first place? Especially since we had this bus adapter idea for devices that might not, you know, be able to implement the memory bus interface. So most recent processors just use memory addresses. But when we have this separate I.O. bus, you know, we basically are doing the same thing we do with these magic memory locations. We just can't use a normal move instruction to access them. Instead, in x86, we have to use these in and out instructions, which are basically just, you know, a special version of move that, you know, does the same thing, but on a different bus. So the question is, is this a type of move instruction on a processor? So these instructions in assembly, like, literally look, you know, literally the name is in and out. So they're not moves in x86. But the parameters they take are very, you know, look very much like a move. So now that we know about how we communicate with devices directly, we can look at the code that the XV6 keyboard interrupt handler actually uses. You know, that this is the code that's called from trap to talk to the keyboard. And there's two control registers we can access. There's a status register, which is on that I.O. bus with address 64 hex, and a data buffer with address 60 hex. And this INB function is a wrapper for the one byte in instruction. So what does the interrupt handler do? It reads from the status register, and there's a bit in the integer return from this which indicates, is there data in the buffer or not? If there is no data, we just return. We didn't actually need to run for some reason, but we did anyways. And if there is, we read from the data buffer to get the key press that actually happened. And then there's some code after this to interpret this, the key press information, because it turns out that, you know, if I press an A, that's not necessarily what's in this data field. It's not the ASCII for A necessarily. And as a sort of special thing about this being sort of a magical memory location, reading from this data buffer clears the buffer and resets this is there data in buffer bit. So, you know, we don't have to do that bookkeeping ourselves. The hardware has a little extra logic to do that for us to make this more convenient. So questions on, let's see here. Question is, what's ST represent? This is our status. Other questions? Question, does the value of the status register change? So the keyboard controller updates this value based on whether or not it has data to give us. Okay, so what I'm showing you here is that we're reading directly from the device controller, and this is commonly called programmed I/O. That's where we're talking directly to the device controller, and we like run some loop to move data back and forth. We're going to talk later about a different way of doing this. I want to keep this term in mind. Before we move on, talk about sort of alternatives to that, let's do sort of a little review of our sort of general operation of devices and think about this scenario. I have two applications, A and B. A is reading from the network, and B can use the CPU. And note that A is going to try to read from the network, but data is not available right away. So it's going to have to wait. And while it's waiting, if we have one core, we're going to presumably run B on that core. And I'm assuming two applications and one core. Thank you. Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so we have a majority agree on the number of context switches, but we have a lot of disagreement on mode switches. So let's talk about this scenario. So we read to get 8 kilobytes of data, and the data doesn't come until later. So what's going to happen when we read is we're going to make a system call that's going to run the device driver. The device driver, well, it's going to run in kernel mode because we have to, like, communicate with the thing the interrupt handler uses. We have to potentially talk to the device. We have to mark processes as not runnable. So this is going to run in kernel mode, and we're going to realize in the device driver that, oh, I looked in the buffer. I don't have 8 kilobytes of data for you. Sorry. And we're going to wait. And while we're waiting, we'd like to run B because otherwise we're not using the CPU at all. Then this data is going to come in, and that's going to trigger an interrupt for the device driver to run and take care of that data. And the device driver is going to run from the trap handler in kernel mode, and it's going to actually sort of copy the data. And as it does that, it's going to look and say, okay, who is waiting? Let's wake them up. And it's going to mark A as ready. And two different things could happen here. So one thing is that after the exception, we could say, okay, it's ready, but let's keep running B. Or we could say, let's run A right away. And this depends on our scheduling algorithm. So supposing we run A right away, we're going to switch to A, copy from the buffer to A, and basically, you know, what you should think of this as is that this whole thing here, I should use a different color. I want to use a color which doesn't conflict. So this whole thing here, this is the read call. It's just done in two pieces, but we start the read call here, we go to sleep in the middle of the read call, and then we wake up and finish it. And after we return from the read, the program runs for a bit. I'm guessing that we don't decide to schedule B in the meanwhile, though maybe we could. And then we, you know, it calls read again. And this call to read doesn't need to wait on the device. So it just, you know, finishes after copying from the buffer that was filled in the kernel from here, from the interrupt handling. So a question, did the device controller trigger an interrupt on the processor once network data was incoming? The device controller needs to trigger an interrupt whenever there's, you know, some work for the OS to do to handle some data. And presumably something that we didn't like show in detail is that the device driver is going to do that sort of work at boot to like configure the device controller to send an interrupt at times when it has something it wants to do. And in this case, one thing it wants to do is take data from the network and put it somewhere. So sort of the counts I get for this are I either get 6 switches, 2 user and kernel and back, and you'd say 3 if you're like counting each one as half. But I would count 6 mode switches, or if we run B again in this part, 8 mode switches. As for context switches, I like the answer of 2, or I think, I like the answer of 2. So I think that's sort of what we would expect. So that's on how a device driver works. And I mentioned this programmed I/O idea. Can I explain why it's 2? We're running A, then we're running B here. and then we switch back to running A. I don't count running the bottom half of the device as a context switch, because this isn't really running on behalf of any program. It's just running for the OS. Okay. So far we've been talking about, that when we want to get data from the device, it goes from the hardware into the device controller, and then we read it from the device controller onto the processor, and then we take it from the processor and send it to our memory, where, it's in the buffer for the kernel. Something that we might observe is that, the device controller's connected to the memory. Why don't we just have it do that, send it there directly? And this is something that, in fact, is done. It's called direct memory access. So the way this works is the OS will tell the device controller, hey, I would like you to use, this location here in memory, which is going to be, somewhere in here, as the place where you store this data, rather than having a buffer in your controller, just use that memory for me. And so when this device controller is talking to the hardware, rather than writing to a buffer it has internally, it's going to write directly to where the OS asks to put the data. And the OS can read from there. And if the OS sets this up correctly, we've avoided an extra copy. Where previously we had to have it be copied into the device controller's buffer and then to the memory. Now the device controller can hopefully write it almost directly to the actual memory. And we can also do the same thing with cases where the device controller needs to read from a buffer and send it to the device. We can have it read from the memory rather than having the OS copy it through the processor to a buffer on the device controller. So this is, something that we often will do because it's way faster when we have a lot of data to copy. And this is, what you would hope that your disk and network controllers support. And in modern systems, they always support it. And ideally, the device will put the data where the OS wants it. Now, you might say, so that's where I'm reading it into. Well, it's going to be typically in the kernel buffer for the data. It's actually very hard to arrange to put it actually where the application's going to read or write it, though we can try to do that with a bit of extra work. So questions on this direct memory access idea? Question, does the OS control what range the device writes to? Yes, and that's because the device controller is going to have a control register where the OS sets what memory address it uses. And our hope is that the device controller uses this to determine where to write to. And another question, the processor doesn't help with the writing? Yeah, so in this scheme, the writing, if the device controller is getting the data from the device, the processor is not involved in writing it to the memory. So a question is, how is it actually written then? It's going to be written using the same way the processor would write something to memory. And we kind of have to support, having different things write to the memory already if we think about multiple cores, where we'd actually have multiple processors hooked up to this memory bus. And a question, does each device have its own device controller? So conceptually, yes. In practice, we might have some sort of sharing. Like this bus adapter is kind of a device controller that's shared between multiple devices. Other questions? Question, do we need to worry about locking? And yes, and that's something that the memory bus is going to have to implement with some hardware. But that's going to be done by the hardware, so the software doesn't need to worry about it. But yeah, some part of this will need to worry about, you know, locking in this. Okay. So, generally, the OS is going to, you know, use when the device controller supports direct memory access, which we want for large data transfers, that's what the device is going to, OS is going to use. And typically, we're going to have a device driver buffer that the OS is going to specify as where it should read and write, you know, avoiding that extra step. Conceptually, we could specify like where you're trying to read it into, but this is really hard to make work. And I have a whole bunch of reasons here why, you know, this often is not possible in practice, even though when you can pull it off, it can be a bunch faster. Questions on devices. Okay, so I'm going to briefly start talking about file systems. So we talked about how we communicate with devices, and we're going to look at how we build file systems on top of a storage device. And when we talk about storage devices, we're going to talk about hard drives or solid-state disks. And the interface that, you know, the device controllers expect is basically based off hard drives. So I'm going to show you what a hard drive is. So a hard drive has these platters that store magnetically encoded data, which is read by these heads, which physically swing on this arm to ride over where the data is stored, and the disk rotates and the heads go over places where there's magnetically encoded data, which is divided up into these sectors. And we can group these sectors up into these larger units that we're not going to be talking about this semester. And solid-state disks work very differently, but they have the same idea that they're going to divide up their stored data into these sectors, and the interface that the OS is going to use to talk to a disk, a solid-state disk or a hard drive, is that they're going to take requests in their disk controller, which are going to have a bunch of sector numbers, which could be just a list of individual sector numbers or possibly maybe ranges of sector numbers, and they're going to get data for the whole sector. And a sector is going to be something that's, you know, not just a single byte. Typical sizes are between half a kilobyte and 4 kilobytes. So 512 bytes to, you know, 4KB, depending on the hard drive or solid state disk. And the disk controller is going to assign different numbers to each sectors, and typically things that have close sector numbers are going to be physically close on the disk, meaning that you'd like to keep things, you know, with adjacent sector numbers together because they'll be faster to read or write together. And for spinning disk, this is a big deal, and there's been a lot of stuff that file systems do to try to take advantage of spinning disks. For solid state disks, it doesn't really matter that much. Because there's not something that's physically spinning we have to worry about that's going to affect how long it takes to read or write something. And the OS, it sends these sector numbers to read or write to the disk, and the disk controller will typically have a list of these requests, a queue, and it will process them in some order, and the OS can specify restrictions on that. So it can say, hey, I want you to write, you know, 1, 5, 7, 9, and 10, and make sure you write 1 before you write 10. But I don't care about the order of the other things. So questions on this interface? So given that we have these sectors, we're going to talk about next time about implementing a file system using this. And we're going to introduce the FAT file system, which is going to be also the subject of our next assignment after the paging assignment. And the FAT file system is probably the simplest file system, which is why we have an assignment on it, and which is why we, you know, are going to talk about it first. And it's named for its main data structure, which is called the file allocation table. And we're going to look at what that is next. But I think that's where I'm going to stop for today, and we'll cover that next time. So questions before I sign off. Question is the paging assignment the last assignment where we use XV6? Yes.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Do we have to do any preparation for the final, or will that just be like at the end?
That'll be at the end. It won't be released until sometime in the final period. And
all right,
I hope to use the last lecture for sort of a final review.
All right, sounds good.
Other questions?